Good morning and welcome back to the Earl Abrams Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Or should I say the Sandy Williams and Earl Abrams Show?
I think you should, Earl. I'm the only guy.
Welcome back. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. It means Fridays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. And, Sandy, I want to thank you, man, for filling in the other day.
I had fun Wednesday. We talked about you for 3 hours.
Oh, man.
That's not true.
Keeping the home fires burning, huh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, that's... You know,
flaming.
It's
flaming is what they were doing.
Anyway, let's get right at it, Sandy. Aaron Rodgers, is he or is he not a prima donna?
Is there any question whatsoever? Holy cow. The only person who thinks he isn't a prima donna is Aaron Rodgers. And, of course, that's because it's hard to be have that much self-awareness.
I can't believe what you just told me.
Yeah, I saw the Pat McAfee show, the one that he was on.
Right.
And on the show, he kind of leans back and says, you know, I might be the greatest football player that's ever played for Green Bay. And I'm thinking, you know, that might be true, Aaron, but it shouldn't come out of your mouth. Holy moly. And then he kind of wanted to kind of, you could tell, see, he was thinking about it, picturing, yeah, I am the greatest, yeah.
He said that?
He said exactly what I said. I think I might be the greatest. He said, you know, there's Bart Starr, there's some others, but I think, you know, I've got my 15-year record, and
You know, there's another guy who was before him who people may argue.
Brett Favre?
Was without question.
Well, look, my point is not, it's very hard to move through time
and
decide who's the greatest. Be honest with you, Reggie White was probably the greatest football player to play for the Packers, but... You know, in terms of all this talent and everything, he's got great talent, but it shouldn't come out of his mouth.
No, there's got to be some humility. And he doesn't have any.
No, apparently not. You could mine him for that, and I think you'd come up short.
Yeah, I mean, to say that, I'm sure other Hall of Famers. I was listening to Leroy Butler the other day, and maybe that's why I've never heard him talk in a negative sense ever about Aaron Rodgers, but maybe he heard that. And he knows, when you look at the list of great Packers, and this is going back, man, to, I don't know.
You have to go through, I mean, you look at people in their era to see how they compare to, you know, the talent at the time. You know, that end that the Packers had that caught, you know, was way ahead of his time.
I'm looking and trying to remember those kind of guys.
Johnny Blood back before that.
Yeah.
You know, they had some great, great football players who were standouts in their time in fantastic ways. And anyway, you know, you have to go by position.
Yes.
Quarterback gets a lot more attention. It probably does require a whole skill set. But football involves might. It involves power.
So if you go through the Hall of Fame, you go back to the beginning of football.
Yeah.
And I'll bet you now one of the people in the Hall of Fame said,
I'm the greatest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on.
And the only guy who ever said that was Muhammad Ali, and he said it tongue-in-cheek, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's a good thing that he clearly wore out his welcome. You know, there are some fans who are still going to say, you know, we need Aaron back. But the new era is starting.
Yeah.
Long overdue. Actually, they made a major mistake a year ago when Aaron was kind of pushing the envelope. Hey, I'm the star. You know, I don't need to come. I'll come in when I'm ready. And they said yes and gave him $150 million.
Well, I think the mistake they made was thinking that they had a roster that with Aaron Rodgers was going to get to the Super Bowl or would be knocking on its door.
Yeah, they did think that.
And it turns out that, you know, with the injuries they had, how it all played out, Aaron Rodgers at his best wouldn't have gotten them to the Super Bowl. And they didn't get there by a long shot. And so, you know, they misjudged. I would put that on Gutekunst and Murphy and the people who must have felt like they had to
re-sign
him. Pressure. They had to sign him because, wow, he put the Packers in a corner that it's going to take them several years to get out of.
You know, Sandy, you just touched base on, again, they felt the pressure. And because some of the fans said, hey, we don't want, what's the guy's name, the backup quarterback?
Jordan Love.
We're not ready for Jordan Love. You know, we don't want him. We want Aaron. And they panicked. And they listened to the crowd.
Actually, I think the whole NFL is panicking a bit because they've concluded, based on the current style, that franchise quarterbacks, guys who are really good, are worth everything, right?
Yeah.
So they're signing even people who don't have anywhere near the talent that Aaron Rodgers have. They're signing him to $40 million.
Jimmy Garoppolo got $40 million
a year. So that's what Aaron Rodgers is getting, right? About.
You're right.
So, you know, the price for a quarterback has gone way up. It makes the decision they made about Aaron Rodgers look a little better because you look at the dead cap space that was taken up by who was it that was traded that left behind $40 million. I mean, it's happening around the league now that quarterbacks are getting overpaid. They get traded. They leave behind huge dead cap space, so that they're creating payroll problems on every team. And it's I think what's going to happen is that the Eagles' form of offense, which takes a powerful quarterback that can pass and converts it into a game winning scenario. Like this guy Richardson that's up for draft now is a redo of the quarterback the Eagles have, and I think he's going to get drafted high, and they're going to start finding quarterbacks that have 10-year shelf lives that run the ball and pass and are cheaper than the kind of quarterback.
So do we know? No, we don't know because the deal's not done. We don't know if the Packers have to pay a percentage of that $60 million.
No, we don't know that, and apparently that my guess is they will because cap space is a problem for every team, and that the more of it they pay, the more they'll get in the way of draft choices. But they don't have a lot of leverage, you know. How much leverage do they have? They've said they don't want him. He says he doesn't want to be there. Okay, end of game. I mean, he can retire if he decides to.
And they still have to. The Packers would have to pay.
Then the Packers have to pay.
Because the deal's not consummated.
And the dead cap space goes up when he retires because all of his advance payments roll back into the year of retirement. So he's most expensive to the Packers if he retires. So this guy has all the leverage, really, Aaron Rodgers does. And he's demonstrated, basically, that he's got no loyalty. You know, he talks about the green and gold and how they've been to him and what have you, but he's got him over
well,
the barrel.
Well, you know, he came back from, Sandy, maybe that's what I need to do. Maybe I need to go to a 4-day blackout or whatever it's called.
Yes, you need a 4 days of darkness.
Yeah, but as it turned out,
I thought you lived in that, basically.
It wasn't. Hey, I understand what that means.
No, I didn't. I did not mean that.
I'm only joking. No, Sandy, I'm talking about with not seeing things clairvoyantly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I understand that, but not the other side. But what I'm saying is it wasn't all darkness. There were I read where, you know, he could go and turn the lights on, and there were some other things. So it really wasn't that. He really is a strange guy.
He's decided to cultivate strangeness, he kind of believes in this transparency. He's living his life transparently, but then he talks about it and as if everyone cares about it. And I guess enough people do care about it. He's become essentially like other social media influencers. He's beginning to behave like an influencer. And this whole fascination with doing everything through the Pat McAfee show.
Right.
If you ever watch that, you can see it's like, this is kind of a weird media process.
Well, they're not going to ever push against Aaron. He's safe there.
Yeah.
You know, the other part of it is, how does he have almost 40?
39. Yeah, he's going to be 40 next year.
And he's Joe Namath, right? He's Playboy.
Rogers?
Yeah, he's...
Maybe, yeah, you know.
Well, he's got yeah, come on, man. Yeah. He's, you know, he's got a different woman every couple months.
I don't know about that. He seems to have trouble settling down. I think who knows? We watch all this stuff from the outside because it's, you know, like now Jimmy Garoppolo, they're talking about he's perfect for Las Vegas. Look at him.
Yeah. He's a matinee item.
Yeah.
Jimmy Garoppolo.
Garoppolo,
and he's always been that way. But anyway, we got to go to a break. And so when we come back, we're going to get into some substantive things. And so we're going to talk a little bit about, Sandy, I want you to explain inherent dangers in Poland, stepping outside of what the United States and what NATO.
Yeah, Slovakia too. Now.
Yeah,
Slovakia followed suit today.
Yeah, so these people are independent of NATO. I mean, if they can do this, we got to go to a break first. When we come back, that's what we're going to be talking about. 844-967-2789. I was going to say Monday, man. It's Friday. All right. We'll be right back.
Come on, talk to me. You can see what's going on.
Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday, and that means Fridays with my co-host Sandy Williams. Sandy, another, you know, this whole war in Ukraine has so many different layers. And now Polish president has agreed to send as 9 MiG, you know, planes or jets, MiG-29s in Slovakia.
Yeah, Slovakia. I just read, I think, their number is 4 that they're sending of some MiG-29s. I think they are, which are a 1980s vintage jet. That's and apparently the jets are to be used for mostly defensive purposes,
right,
to be able to attack aircraft from Russia that might come over to try and neutralize their air supremacy. To date, Russia has been relatively circumspect about using aircraft over Ukraine because their anti-aircraft capability with ground-to-air missiles has been quite good, and they lost quite a few planes. These planes are also apparently capable of defending against cruiser missiles. That's a bigger problem. And so they do need to figure out how to defend against cruiser missiles in a manner that might be more effective than what they currently got, which is clearly basically just ground-to-air defenses against cruiser missiles. And so my understanding is that's the purpose. It's also my understanding this isn't being done under the aegis of NATO, nor with the complicity of the United States. In fact, I'm confident the United States is sending back-channel messages to Russia saying, hey, we're not subsidizing this. We're not making it possible for this to happen. And Ukraine itself has announced that the way they're going, I mean, that Poland itself has announced that the way they're going to replace these aircraft is independently they're going to go out and buy aircraft from South Korea, which is not a member of NATO. And in the near term and in the long term, they plan on buying U.S. aircraft. But that's a long term. So it's not what the original thing that was being talked about months ago was Poland wanted the United States to basically put planes on a ship and send them over to Ukraine to immediately replace a bunch of MiGs that would be sent by Poland to Ukraine. And that's the deal that Biden and the United States said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to get involved in essentially providing directly or indirectly aircraft to Ukraine. So I think this does get closer to the line for the United States and Ukraine. But so long as these planes don't fly over Russia, and so long as they are used defensively by Ukraine, I think that this is probably still within what other these goofy rules are. You know, this is a war that's fought with unspoken rules, and I think they're getting closer to the edge of the envelope on the rules with this. But it's actually Poland and Slovakia acting independently.
You know, Sandy, it does dig it even deeper. And we can say, or somebody can say to Ukraine, you can't use it to do offensive things, but they're watching their country being destroyed.
Yeah, and
you think they're gonna adhere to that?
Well, the problem is also, I mean, you watch the war and it's kind of going the way everyone knew it would go originally. I mean, the United States and everyone else forecasted the war taking 2 weeks. But the reason they thought it would take 2 weeks is they thought it was such an inevitable victory that Russia, that Ukraine would lay down its arms quickly and not suffer huge losses of casualties and infrastructure damage, et cetera. But no, they dug in their heels and fought. And the allies made it possible, the NATO allies made it possible right. for them to do it. But ultimately now, the United States is talking about how we're running around the world trying to find artillery shells to supply them with because they're running out of artillery and ammunition rapidly. Russia put itself on wartime footing. So they've got factories churning out that stuff the same way we did during World War II. Nobody else in the world has put themselves on wartime footing. So to date, they've been drawing ammunition out of inventory, basically, and those inventories are depleted. And we don't produce munitions at the rate that would be necessary in for that war. So they're running out of two things in Ukraine. People, you know, the military, the Ukrainian military is talking about how they've basically lost all their seasoned soldiers but to death and casualty. You know, the estimates, neither country will, Ukraine or Russia doesn't release its own numbers, but third-party observers look at it, and the ones who seem to be most distant and arm's length about their numbers would suggest that the casualties for Ukraine are probably up in the 200,000 range, and the casualties for Russia probably exceed that number. But which country can better absorb that?
Well, clearly Russia, because of the sheer numbers of people that they have.
Right, right.
And so you would think, Sandy, that by now Ukraine would eventually, if this thing continues, start drafting even younger people to fight in the war. Right? I mean, if it comes to a point in time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're conscripting both older and younger people. You know, the country has a finite number of men
right.
to fight. I'm sure women are fighting, too. So it's both men and women. But, you know, the horror is that in a war, I mean, here we are talking about a country depleting its people.
Right.
You know, through death. And it's happening on both sides, but Russia just has more people that can't deplete. So here we are kind of clinically talking about the horror of a war. And, you know, as I've said, I've long thought that in some respects we were complicit in provoking it. But now this needs to get settled, because it's not going to get settled on the battlefield without millions dead.
All right, got to go to a break. Dave, I see you. Be right back. It's Friday. It's Fridays with my co-host Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.
Dave from Atlanta.
Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday, and that means my co-host Sandy Williams is in the studio. We're talking about, you know, the fact that Poland and Slovakia are offering about 13 MiG-29 fighters to Ukraine. Let's go to the phone lines and David. Hey, David, how you doing, man? You say what?
Good morning, gentlemen. Really quickly, so this has been concerning me for quite a while. If you remember a while ago, we were not supposed to send tanks to Ukraine. We have now agreed to send our better tanks over to Ukraine in the very near future. Germany is going to be sending the latest, most advanced tanks to Ukraine here in the very near future. It should be noted that the Javelin missiles that we gave them, that was in our inventory, that was a 13-year supply, and they've pretty much burned that up already. And the thing is, what I look at is, and when I was waiting for commercial break, President Xi is supportive of Russia, and he's meeting with him in Moscow next week. And China has made it very clear with their deals. One of the reasons why, if you remember, I'm sure Sandy remembers this, the sanctions that we put on Russia have backfired, because this is cozied up. Russia is now cozied up with China as an alternative. And if you just saw, China supposedly made an agreement, people are kind of blowing this off, between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And so China is now taking the lead with what's going on diplomacy-wise. And I don't know what Joe Biden's end game is here, because he hasn't really said what the end game is here. We don't really seem to have a plan. I think that what you're seeing here is basically a, and keep in mind, Sweden and Norway are supposed to join NATO this summer.
Finland, too. Yeah.
It's a huge mess. And at the end of the day, the fact that President Xi is meeting Vladimir Putin in Moscow is very troubling to me. And I don't know where Sandy sits with that, but I know you've been supportive of China, but they made it very clear now that they're definitely supporting Russia.
Well, I'm not supportive of Russia or China. I just worry about the U.S. policies vis-a-vis these countries, because one of the reasons that China is meeting with Russia is we've not only pushed Russia into the arms of China, but we're pushing China into the arms of Russia. So, you know, our notion of isolating the people we don't like, for trying to isolate them and trying to diminish their economic power, has the very effect of pushing other people together. Right now, as we talk, I believe, Russia, Iran, and China are on the verge of conducting naval practice, naval efforts together. And so, you know, they're beginning to demonstrate the cohesion that might exist militarily between these entities. And so, you know, I agree with you. I think the reason Xi is meeting with Putin first and then going to have some kind of virtual conference with Zelensky is because he's going to present to Zelensky the fact that if Zelensky doesn't come to the negotiating table and they don't work out something that is satisfactory to Russia in some fashion, that Xi will open his arsenal to Russia and make it possible for Russia, because Russia's running out of things too. You know, their isolation, even though they're on a war footing, both sides are using munitions up at a rate that modern warfare has never seen before. I mean, and you can see this when you see social media pictures of battles. All the soldiers are putting their rifles up over the edge of the trench. They aren't sighting them to see. They just shoot bullets off in the direction. So people are using munitions like mad, and that's what you do when you're in fear of your life. Yes, I think that the Xi meeting with Putin is very important, and I think that China is in a position to broker a settlement. It's not going to be to broker a settlement that brings Russia to its knees. I think it's going to be to broker a settlement that probably secures more or less what Russia has wanted out of this without breaking the back of Ukraine, which I continue to believe is resolving the Crimea situation, the Donbas situation, and preserving the neutrality of Ukraine in the running forward in the future. And I think China will end up being in a position to do that. One of the promises they'll be able to make to Ukraine is they'll extend their Belt and Road projects into Ukraine and help Ukraine rebuild itself, which is putting their money where their mouth is, probably faster than the United States can.
Well, the other thing that should be noted, Sandy, as well, if you notice, Australia just announced they're going to be buying the latest nuclear subs from the United States, and this is ticking off China as well. And so there is a coordination, and I've told this to Earl, if you look at the fact that who we're kind of closing up to, Japan, NATO countries, Australia, and what have you, and then you've got Russia, China, Iran, now kind of in the mix, and North Korea, of course. There's a lot of countries and leaders involved, and this is especially what we just saw with the Russian fighter jet trying to, actually knocking one of our larger drones, and it's like the size of a car, I guess. And it shows when they were dumping the gasoline on there trying to, destroy it.
There is a strong
potential. I think the seeds are there. I do.
The seeds are there for what?
I think for something much bigger than what you're seeing
question.
Right now.
No question.
I think what's happening is that the sides are lining up. Not that they, hopefully, I pray, will actually come to go beyond sword rattling. And I think one of the reasons it won't happen is we don't even understand fully how totally inextricably tied up China is with the rest of the world, and how unlikely it is that very many countries in the world will be interested in going to war with China, and how disinterested China is in going to war with the rest of the world, because their economy is inextricably tied up with, for instance, the European Union. They also are one of the biggest trading partners of Australia. And so Australia, in spite of the fact that they talk tough about China, we can never replace China in terms of its proximity and its capacity to be a trading partner with a number of these places. So the United States is trying to foster these alliances, and there are willing participants in them. But the nuclear-powered subs aren't necessarily nuclear armed, although they always have that potential. But they are a modern submarine, and submarines are more or less offensive kinds of weapons to be put offshore of another country to threaten them with the potential for missiles. But I think that there's going to be a sobering up, and hopefully the American foreign policy will be caused to sober up in this next 2024 campaign. Maybe we can stop having this bipartisan lockstep jingoism that likes to paint a country like China into an enemy status, or to paint Russia clearly into an enemy status, because an isolation Cold War with China will be very difficult, very difficult.
Hey, Sandy, I want to kind of change the subject. And I was reading this article the other day, and it took me back to Reaganism. You remember the Reagan Revolution?
Oh, yeah. We're still suffering its echo, because his attack on government is what has caused our regulatory processes to fail so in utter. Ultimately, the attack on government that has been at sometimes bipartisan has caused government to fail us every time we need it.
So the Reagan Revolution lasted all of these decades, and so they'd always talk about Reagan, 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 Reagan. Well, it's changed now. The MAGA Revolution, is it safe to say, has overtaken the Reagan Revolution?
Well, I think most of the MAGA people would want to wrap themselves in the Reagan flag.
Yeah,
as being the wellspring of their ideology, but that's losing sight of what the Reagan ideology was. Just the same way that everyone wraps themselves in the flag of Teddy Roosevelt, whether they're liberals or conservative.
So the Reaganism that we heard constantly and that spurned many of, you know, the Bushes, the what was the guy's name?
Newt Gingrich.
Those acolytes
spawned those. Yeah,
yeah, and so that went on for such a long time. It's safe to say that part is kind of a done deal now. I don't think.
Well, maybe. I mean, my view is that Paul Ryan was an extension of Reaganism. You know, his libertarian views, his worshiping at the Ayn Rand temple. All of that has been pushed aside by the MAGA movement. The problem with the MAGA movement is it doesn't have a defined ideology to speak of. You know, if you said, what's the philosophy that is being pursued by the MAGA movement, it would be hard to describe it other than anger and anti-establishmentism and being coincident with the interest of private interests. They would say that they're they're draining the swamp, you know, in the deep state, but they're really just draining the swamp in favor of private interests.
Do you think the MAGA movement will have the staying power that Reaganomics had?
Well, I think the MAGA movement, if you really get to its heart, is a movement towards autocracy, and I do fear that the movement toward autocracy has some wind in it. There was some reporting about the most recent meeting of the Federalist Society, which is basically young conservatives, and they're beginning to question the ground rules of the old version of American democracy, and I fear the reason for that is that as the demographics of the country change, the ground rules of democracy, one person, one vote, everyone votes, you know, we use the rule of the majority as the direction we go, becomes less satisfactory to conservatives who have a different agenda.
I'm listening to you say that, and that is an amazing thing to say in a nation that has prided itself on one man, one vote.
We're a country that's
transformative, no question.
We're a country that's given lip service to one man, one vote. We haven't had it very much of the time. It took the voting, the Civil Rights Act in the 60s to move us closer to that. There's been great apathy amongst some of the voters, so that the voting system and our socio demographics have been such that, like the, you know, we talk about gerrymandering. A lot of that is just the result of the concentration in the cities of the people who end up being Democrat. And our parties have sort of balkanized us. But, I think the conservative movement is not comfortable with and it was proven by the big lie concept.
Got to get you a hold of thought, Sandy. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back. Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And where is it at, Sandy? Let's see. Okay. We're finally reshoring manufacturing. It's hard for me to believe this. And they're already taking the jobs away from Americans. So do you think we're reshoring manufacturing? Do you see that?
Bringing it back to America? Well, you know, the annual jobs report suggested that manufacturing jobs weren't going up that rapidly. So there's definitely evidence that on the supply chain side, there are companies trying to bring back some vital kinds of things to the United States. We've got these subsidies that the government has put out for chip manufacturing in the in the Renewables Act. There's some subsidies for instance, battery and electric automobile manufacturing onshore. I noticed that Volkswagen is going to build batteries in North America. Yeah, but they're moving it to Canada, not the United States. You know, I don't know the extent to which it's going to happen. I do know that at the time of the pandemic and the problems with China with the tariffs and the interruptions in the supply chain from China itself that resulted from that, much of the rejobbing was not reshoring, but rather went to Vietnam and some other places that were capable of replacing China in the supply chain. With some of the same advantages that China presented. So I don't know. I think to some extent it's a pipe dream to think that we can reshore the kind of jobs that have decided they would not be onshore, particularly when lots of the growth for many of the multinational corporations headquartered in the United States, most of the growth for a lot of these companies occurs in other countries. So America's marketplace is not anywhere near as rapidly growing as other marketplaces, for instance, like China. I was interested that over half of Volkswagen's profits now come from sales in China. And I think an increasing number of multinational manufacturers are finding that their profits, either their current profit growth or their future potential profit growth lies outside the United States, and that will have a lot to do with where people are going to locate new manufacturing facilities.
So help me understand, because, you know, back when all the manufacturing was being done in this country, you know, you had a limited amount of people who would buy the product because we're small.
Well, no, but the United States, back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, the United States was the consumption economy. Consumption here was growing rapidly. people were buying second cars for the first time. That was like a way to double the sales. You know, car sales went up dramatically during the 50s and 60s as the average American family went from one car to two cars.
Yeah, but Sandy, we only had, 200 million people.
Yeah, but growth in business is a function of how much you're selling this year and how much it's going to grow to next year. So the car, you know, the fact is that automobile manufacturers in America in the 50s and 60s and 70s were not exporting a significant percentage of the automobiles they were making. They were being sold here in the United States. And consumption patterns in the United States supported a rapidly growing kind of consumption growth for a time. You know, but when you have growth like that, you reach a saturation level in any country, and pretty soon all people are doing is replacing what they already bought. They aren't expanding the things they buy. They're simply replacing what they have. And the United States economy has for a long time been in a replacement mode for most of the major goods that are manufactured, other than the circumstance when the marketplace creates a new product that nobody has yet. So the smartphone right. Burst onto the scene. Nobody had one, so you weren't replacing something you had. You were buying the first one, and you were also buying an evolving technology so that you replaced it when it got different enough and better enough, so you replaced it.
So help me understand why then, Sandy, when the 80s and the 90s and they moved the manufacturing to China and other places, they the market that they opened up, Harley Davidson, all those Chinese, they certainly had a larger market to sell to than when they just remained in America. They're not going to ever go back. How will they ever go back to a smaller market?
They won't. And that's my point. So, you know, if the globalization, the genie's out of the bottle, and it isn't just globalization for manufacturing, it's the flip side of that is the globalization for sales, okay? And so, you know, for instance, Harley Davidson. Harley Davidson saw a significant growth market as India.
Right.
They created a manufacturing facility in India. Well, of course you would. Why would you?
It's a growing market.
It's a growing market. They have plenty of workers there. You can make motorcycles there and
right.
sell them there without putting them on a boat and suffering all those consequences. And you can pay the prevailing wage.
Cheaper than cars.
You can pay the prevailing wage in India and sell the product in India at a price that the Indians can afford, and you can still make a profit. So this is the kind of decision making based on facts that's ongoing in the marketplace. And so, you know, the initial move towards globalization in terms of production was done at a time when we were still selling almost everything in the United States. But beginning in the 90s, the world opened up. And the world has opened up more and more over time, such that there's more and more products being sold around the world by companies that are multinational, headquartered in the United States. And the things that they sell aren't necessarily
so
made
so then
here.
Based on what you just said, then this the to believe that reshoring of manufacturing, it's kind of a pipe dream.
I think it's a nifty pipe dream that people can talk about. Some things will get reshored, but like I said, the jobs report suggests that there aren't a lot of new manufacturing jobs, so we're losing them as rapidly as we're gaining them probably. And so, you know.
And this is really directed at China.
Well, it's
right?
We talk about China all the time, but it's not just China.
Okay.
You know, I had a guest on the air on Wednesday, John Hopkins, and his business is doing its work in Nepal.
You got to hold the thought because we got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. So that does, I mean, this guy's the executive director of the Institute for Sound Public Policy, founder U.S. Tech Workers. You know, he and others think that there's going to be these reshoring of manufacturing, and maybe there are people who may think, hey, we're going back.
Don't you?